Hello and welcome back to the 7MLC podcast with me, your host, Michael Lewis Cunningham. Joining me on the pod today is special guest and professional player Lily Dubuck. Although Lily first started kicking a ball around in a remote town in California with a population of just 750 people, her playing journey has taken her all over Europe. Her story is a fascinating one to say the very least, and I'm excited to be able to share this one with you. So let's jump right in. Lily, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today. How are you doing?
Good. Happy to be here.
So, of course, I'd love to get to know your journey. I know from doing a little bit of scouting around your Instagram, I've seen you traveled a lot playing. But if you could just let us know where you've grown up. I know we've caught up just a little bit now, but for those listening, just give a little bit of background, how you got into playing football, where your journey's taken you so far.
Yeah, so I'm from a pretty remote town in the mountains of California. So when I was six, my dad put me in the local league. My mom said, I want them to be ballerinas. And my dad said, well, let's try football. He was first generation in the US. And I have a sister who's 2 years older. And it was the one thing I was better than her at to start. You know, we were always chasing an older sibling. And I loved it, loved the running, loved the game. But where I'm from, not a lot of girls play. So I grew up playing with the Mexican boys because we have a big Mexican population, which, you know, I'm 5'10". And trying to emulate a Mexican style. I'm sure I looked ridiculous out there, but their love of the game and the pickup and the culture, I kind of found myself, that's the only option. So that's what you adapt to. And then went off and played club soccer in Sacramento for a club called Placer United, which I was there until I was 18. Got a scholarship to go play in San Francisco at a Division II, because at the time I wasn't sure if I wanted to do one. Because as girls were always, you know, you're not going to make it as a pro. So education comes first.
That's what you're told growing up.
Yeah. So in my head, I was like, all right, if you go to Division I schools, you're not going to be able to study enough. So, all right, Division II is the nice mix between playing and studying. In reality, I wish I would have gone D1 because I loved football at a higher standard than a lot of the other girls did. They played casually. Versus, you know, you went through the same thing where you're up at 6 a.m. for training. And to me, I'm up because I want to get better. Mm-hmm. I can make friends later on in life or in different aspects. Usually 6 a.m. fitness tests isn't the best way to make a friend. So did that for 4 years, graduated, did my last semester at Oxford in England, played there. No one goes to Oxford to play football. So had a great time, got moved from a winger to a central midfielder. Just because I had a little bit more experience than some of the other girls playing, which was cool to try out a new position, even as an adult. Graduated, thought, all right, you know, football is over. It was a nice time. I enjoyed it. Met a lot of cool people, had a lot of cool experiences, but time to enter the real world. Went to the real world for about a year. Hated it. Missed football so much. I joined about every rec team I could find in the Boston area where I was living, where if, you know, you need a co-ed team, you need a girl. A lot of the rules in co-ed leagues of Boston is a girl has to be on the field the whole time.
Yeah, I've played in some of those, not in Boston, but yeah.
Yeah, in those leagues. I've played in a couple of them where it's someone's girlfriend or sister who's standing in the corner because they have to have a girl on the team, but they couldn't find anyone who actually plays. So I got to the point where I was playing pretty much every night on whatever team would take me, and I realized how much I missed the game. Mm. The pandemic hit, and then I got my first call to go play pro in Portugal. An agent reached out. Said he saw my highlight video that I made back from college, and that kind of started my professional journey.
Wow. Okay. So where was your highlight tape? Just on YouTube or?
Yeah, I just put it on YouTube.
Really?
And ended up finding it through another agent who was looking in England because I had Oxford written in my highlight tape. And so if you searched Oxford female football players, I pop up, which worked out really well. And then suggested Portugal. It was a brand new club starting out in the third division. They were a second division team and then got new ownership. So you have to start at the bottom.
I'm just curious on this moment. So are you just on your emails one day and you just get this random email from a coach, an agent? Talk us through that.
Yeah. So it happened a couple of times where I would get emails thinking that I'm British because as I'm sure you've known, there's a lot of visa issues playing abroad. So they would email, oh, fantastic. Do you want to come play for this fourth, fifth division team? And I would respond back, oh, absolutely. I would love to. I'm American. which would get the, oh yeah, would love to have you, but we can't give you a visa. Mm-hmm. I don't have a high enough education to get a visa otherwise. You know, I have a bachelor's degree, but not a PhD. And so they're like, you know, keep in touch. Let us know if you move here full time. And that happened for a long time. And then this team in Portugal was willing to hire Americans because they wanted to get the image of the team up a little bit. Portuguese are naturally a little bit shorter. So bringing in the big American player for them, who's tall and fast, was bread and butter.
Love it. And then you played in Portugal, third division. How did you play over there? How was the experience? How was the style of play? Was it an easy integration? Language barrier?
It was a bit hit and miss. Yeah. So I went with another American. We both went and loved having her. Thought she was one of the nicest people I've ever met. She's from Indiana, played Division One. I feel like our experiences were almost polar opposite because I grew up in the Mexican community. So I speak enough Spanish on the pitch to get by.
Okay.
Close enough to Portuguese. And I grew up playing pickup soccer. I don't think a lot of girls grew up playing pickup. So she had gone, you know, club to college to pro. Great player, but had never played pickup. In Portugal, every training session is just a pickup game. Two teams, like a school guard, where, all right, I'll take her, I'll take her, I'll take her. And the coach would just be on the sideline, which I think doesn't happen in a lot of professional clubs.
Is that unique to Portugal? Is that unique to Portuguese third division?
I think a little bit of all of it.
Okay.
Because I think the Portuguese, they like to play. So yep. Small-sided games all the time rather than fitness tests or a bunch of long passes. Like the tiki-taka style really suits them. And then our team was a strange one because we had money, which in the women's game is rare. And then in the Portuguese game is even rarer. So we had a lot of really talented players from Portugal and Brazil. And then I feel like we didn't have the coaching structure being a lower division club. So the result was, all right, everyone can play. Let's just let them play, which was fun in moments. But as a footballer, you want to have the structure come from the coaching staff so that you're getting better. So I was a winger and a striker on the team. So pickup was, you know, fine. You try new moves, try new things. And the other American was a center back. So she would do a shrug of, really, we're doing it again. And there was a lot of fouls and a lot of free kicks and a little bit chaotic. So I realized early on that it probably wasn't the right style for me or the right club for me. But I had a 6-month contract. So I played out through the end of the 6 months and said, all right, I don't know if Portugal and more Southern Europe is the right style for me.
Well, that's great that you have to go there to know that, which is awesome. Did you get any experience, whether it was a friendly match or maybe just watching? Did you look at any second division women's teams and first division?
Yeah, so we ended up getting promoted to the second division.
Wow.
To do that, you have to play Benfica's B team. So played against them, won against them in the version. They do a tournament version. So, you know, you have your semis, finals. So we ended up playing them in the semis and winning. We played against some first division clubs in friendlies with COVID. We had a lot of friendlies because you couldn't actually have league games. But if you're within the same district, you're allowed to play each other. So we did that. And I generally believe that the standard between the third division and the first division is almost the same. It all comes down to money. So our team, every single girl was paid. That was our full-time job. We lived in a house together. You went to the gym together. You trained together. No one else was doing other things. So we would win games 10-0.
Wow.
Because if you play against a team that no one's getting paid,
right,
then they don't have time to go to the gym or do fitness or train 5 times a week. So you would have games that would be really competitive against a Benfica where, you know, it's 2-2, 3-2. And then you would have games where it'd just be a blowout. Saw them on their Instagram the other day. They won 22-0.
No.
In the second division.
Man.
I think it's coming down just to money. Because if you can get 5 girls who are fully professional on the team, Portuguese first division isn't even fully professional for women.
You played in Portugal for 6 months. You finished it out. What happened after?
I realized I didn't want to play for that club anymore. Felt like the training sessions were a bit dangerous. Girls would tackle from behind. Nothing was said by the coach. There wasn't a lot of warm up or physical maintenance, which I think is just dangerous. So I went to England for the summer to see in the transfer window what my agent could do. For a moment, I was going to go to Bosnia. Then there was rumors about Germany because women's football is a bit all over the place. Mm. You know, some countries only have 6 teams in their top flight. So if you can get on one of those 6 teams, it's fantastic. But I think they talked to about 30 players at once. So I ended up going to France for a trial in a team. They just got demoted from the first division to the second division and wanted to go back up. But during my 10-day trial, the goalkeeper tore her rotator cuff. You can only have three non-Europeans on your team. The only replacement they could find was Canadian. So brought me in, said, oh, we liked you as a person, we liked you as a player, but winger, striker, you're less important than a goalkeeper. So they sent me packing. They were really kind about it, wanted to stay in touch. I had a really good experience with them. Then I went to Italy to have another trial with a team in San Marino. And the coaching staff was great. The girls were great, but I would be the only non-Italian girl. No one spoke English and the coach didn't speak English, which is a bit of a barrier. And always happy to learn a little bit of the language I'm in. I think it's really important to try. But when you have no one to speak to for months on end, and you know, they offered, oh, we'll get you an Italian tutor, but we don't know when that can happen with COVID. So it's, you know, you and Duolingo for a couple months on end. So I told my agent, you know, I don't think this is somewhere I can be happy. So I ended up going to Denmark to visit some friends, tried out with Brøndby in the Superliga on the last day of the transfer window. Couldn't complete the transfer in time. So I played in the second division for a club called Sundby Bold Club for this past season, but they couldn't get me a long-term visa. Played for 3 months on a tourist visa and just finished about a week and a half ago with them.
So we're all caught up now. So you're you're in an off-season period right now. Yep. So it's interesting what you said about, you know, the barriers on the Italian team, no one speaking English, because I think a lot of people assume football really is an international language. You can communicate in certain ways and get away with it. But I think probably at the professional level, the communication is a lot more detailed and obviously tactics play into that. What were your impressions going from Portugal, France, Italy, Denmark? Is there a huge difference between level and style just based on the local players? If you had to rank them, not necessarily best, worst, but enjoyable, maybe.
Enjoyable. I would, I'd put Denmark as number one. Mm-hmm. Just as a foreign player, it was so easy to integrate. Everyone on the team spoke English. So a normal training session, the coach is speaking in Danish, explaining what we're doing. And I would just lean to the person next to me and go nudge them and go translate. And every single girl on the team was like, okay, yeah, you need orange bib, go over there. We're doing this, this, and this. Like, cool, great, really gave that. So I felt like I could be friends with everyone on the team. Because when you have that language barrier and you can only speak with three or four players, those are the players you hang out with. So I think Denmark was quite easy with integrating in. France, I think the level was so high and they were so structured as a club that maybe if not everyone was speaking perfect English, but they had an assistant coach whose job was purely to explain what was going on to the international players. So having that finance and structure made it easy to be there for 10 days, make sure someone was looking out for you. Italy, they did their best. I always say that football is the easy part. It's everything around it that's challenging. Mm-hmm. So on the pitch, I always knew what we were doing in training sessions because no one's reinventing football. You've probably seen the drill in some version at some point. So it's just the little rules that maybe you don't know, but it's, you know, you leave training, it's only 2 hours a day and then you sit 18 hours and can't speak to anyone. That I think is challenging. And I think that is why I couldn't play for that specific team in Italy at this point in my career. And then Portugal is just things take a little bit longer to happen. And I come from a very structured upbringing. So I would try and set up my bank account, took months. And that frustrates me. I think for other players, it's not a big deal. You know, you just sit back, relax and wait. But I like things to be laid out in front of me in pretty organized fashion. I would probably put them at the bottom of the countries I've played in so far.
Yeah, I mean, that is a big, that's a big part of the US, isn't it? Things are timely here. Time management is huge. I'm curious to know what the perception foreigners have of American footballers. You coming in, do they, is there a perception they have of you? Because I just know growing up, I went to a college where a lot of the England women's team would be in the same classes as me because it was a sports college. And a lot of them wanted to go to the US because at the time it was the only fully professional league. I remember even, I don't know if you've seen the Bend It Like Beckham movie.
Yeah.
Surely, surely you have. But they go off to US, you know, because they want to be pros. And I think in England, we see women's football in the US is really serious. Do other people see you that way?
Yeah, I think so. So Portugal, for example, they brought me and the other American in, and our first meeting with the president and the club director was that we brought you here to change our culture, because the perception is that Americans are fitter than everybody else because we're really the only country in the world that has a built-in semi-pro system with the university system. You train 6 days a week, you lift multiple times a week, you watch film, you travel. It's a professional environment for amateurs. No other country in the world has that for women right now. So when you bring in an American, you can usually guarantee that they'll pass every fitness test and that they already know the gym workouts, which I think is pretty spot on. I think they also think we're a bigger people than we are, which I'm 5'10", which is quite tall for a girl. But I'll go into Portugal and I was head and shoulders taller than every single player. In Denmark and France, that wasn't really the case. So I think in countries like France or Denmark or probably Germany as well, England as well, where you have a developed system, Americans aren't as valuable as we used to be. Okay. Versus in countries like Spain or Portugal or Italy, where they're still developing their professional system, we can come in and show them what it's supposed to look like from a fitness and organizational perspective. Americans also tend to be loud, which is something that, give and take, we talk the entire time. I remember university games, my center back, I don't think, was quiet for more than a minute. And it's just not all that helpful. Some of it was just positive. It's like, oh, great, way to step, nice job, good turn. Now, after playing in foreign countries, I find a bit annoying. Like, I just want the information.
You want the information, yeah.
Yeah. So I like playing in other countries because when someone's speaking to me, it's purely with a purpose because they don't have the language to be able to say all the frilly things. But I do think Americans were used to constantly communicating. And I think in the women's game, that can still help, especially with center backs or center midfielders, to be able to direct the players in front of you. I think we're still missing a little bit in the women's game.
Yeah, I get that. Even the men's game coming over here, I noticed communication, I don't want to call it less valuable, but there's a lot more of it in circumstances which I'm not used to. And it's funny because I can vividly remember certain moments where someone's giving encouragement or something, but I didn't quite hear them. So I'm like, turning like, what are you giving me? What did you say? And they're like, no, I'm just saying good job, well done. And I'm just like, now I'm distracted from the game. I'm like, I appreciate it, but stop talking. Yeah, you can't over communicate. It's interesting that you said that. But did the teams that you played for over Europe, did they have a men's team at the club too?
Yeah, so the Portuguese one didn't, which when I first signed with them, I thought was a great thing because the focus would be on women. We wouldn't just be attached to the men. Now, ever having gone to multiple clubs, the clubs that don't have a men's team, Italy also didn't have a men's team. They had a men's academy, but when you turned 21, you had to go play somewhere else. Denmark and France had both. And the clubs that didn't have a men's team tend to be less structured because they don't have
really
fun. Yeah, I think the team I played for in France, their men had also just dropped from the first division to the second division. And I think the club did a really good job of making sure that money from the men funneled into the women, where they would play, men would play Friday night at the stadium, and then women would play the next day, Saturday at the stadium. But you allowed enough tickets to be sold. You allowed all the training facilities to be the same. So I think it's a problem the U.S. constantly has is U.S. soccer decided that the MLS and the NWSL are separate leagues. So the women have to come up with their own training grounds, their own stadiums, their own organizations, and that costs a lot of money. Why the men have 27 teams and the women have 10. So I do think that having a men's team at this time helps women progress.
That's interesting that you say that, because I would assume it would be the reverse. I thought you were going to tell me that the teams that only had women's team because they can only focus on that is really structured. But you're right. The more I think about it, you can see now on Instagram, women's teams training, like PSG, for example, they train at the same facility now that the men's do, just on a different field. So I think maybe when you're at a club that's used to operating a certain way with a professional men's team, that will filters down, like you said. So the teams that you were at that did have a men's team, did you notice any difference in how the men's team were treated and the women's team were treated in terms of maybe things you had access to, facilities, the gear you got? Was there any difference or was it pretty equal?
Yeah, and France, it was pretty equal as far as I could tell in the 12 days I was there. You know, we could all eat at the clubhouse if we wanted to. Everyone was given apartments. Gear seemed to be pretty straight. Access to trainers was pretty even, like if you had a little twinge or a medical need. We were never told we couldn't go, which was a problem in England. I played for Oxford City as a semi-pro team. There was no physio for the women's team.
No way.
So, you know, I sprained my ankle and I asked, can I go see the physio? And they said, no, he worked for the men and the men aren't training today. Which, coming from the US, was baffling to me of how can you not have a physio at the clubhouse? In Denmark, it was a little bit different because the club I played for, the women were in the second division, but the men were in the sixth, which is such a low division that if you get a yellow card, you have to sit out for 10 minutes.
Really?
Yeah, to stop the aggression, you know, if a fight breaks out and two people get yellow cards and then more guys.
It's like a sin bin.
Yeah, you have a sin bin. So the men weren't paid, whereas some of the women were. But even then, the focus was a little bit more on the men. For example, their coaches had the time to be full-time coaches. They coached the men's first team, then the academy, versus our head coaches were only part-time. So the head coaches took it upon themselves of, all right, we can't pay the men. How else can we entice them to stay at our club versus going to a different club when they get a little bit older and moving up the league? Mm-hmm. So they redid the dressing room for them. They had nicer kit. They had different cold weather kit because Denmark gets pretty cold. So like those little details came into play, and I worked at the academy while I was there as part of my contract. And I would argue, well, why did the men get the whole pitch to train on? We have to split a pitch with somebody every training session. And yet we're in the second division and you're in the sixth. And the response I usually got was, oh, it's the men's team.
And which, over there, that justifies it, does it?
Yeah. No one else had any argument other than it's the men's team.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Do you find, because I know, especially here in the US, it seems a lot of, you know, brands are really supporting, trying to close that gap between how female athletes and male athletes are treated. Do you notice those efforts being made in Europe as much?
Yeah, I think some clubs, Arsenal is always my favorite example. I think on social media, they've done a really good job of promoting their women's team. They did a great clip. I think they shared it on both Arsenal men and Arsenal women, but it's Kieran Tierney taking a free kick and Katie McCabe on the women's team, and they split screen it. It's identical. They both score. They both curl it in left foot into the upper corner. And if you didn't know that she had a ponytail, you couldn't tell it apart. From a distance, it's the same one. And to see that promoted on both sides, and they've been doing a lot of interviews with the men's team asking, who's your favorite player on the women's team? You know, and if you couldn't answer that, I think that would be pretty bad for you as a player. If, you know, they play for your club and you don't know a single woman. So I like seeing that. I think it's a big push for it. But I think it comes right now mainly from the players just being fed up with it rather than from the head honchos.
So you're saying that to continue striving to close that gap, it needs to be the players within the club making more of an effort, not so much an organization trying to enforce certain things. Because I guess sometimes with this topic in particular, but any kind of injustice, I feel like some organizations, they push it and it's awesome, but sometimes it can come across a little forced. I think that's great. They're asking these kind of questions on social media and whatnot, just like it's a normal thing. They're not going above and beyond trying to do some huge, big campaign. It's more the subtler things maybe have more of an impact than, okay, for this one week, we're going to have Female Athlete Appreciation Week or something like that. And it's like, okay, everyone's going to be behind it for a week, but what about the just normal day-to-day activities?
Exactly. And I think the US is a big culprit of that. There's the She Believes Cup. I don't know if you're familiar with it. So it's one of the biggest international tournaments in women's football. But it's an international title. France, Germany, England plays in it, the USA plays in it, and they'll go to one of the four nations. But it's called the She Believes Cup, which I think diminishes it in comparison to, you know, international friendlies. And one year the US decided that they were going to ask all the players on their team to pick a woman that inspired them. And that woman's name was going to be on the back of their shirt. So if you tuned in and managed to click on the She Believes Cup, you would see Carrie Underwood, Beyonce, Miley Cyrus on the back of the shirts, which, you know, if those are the women that inspire you, that's great. Do a video about it with the team. But would you ever imagine Beckham or Kane saying, no, you're going to take my name off my own shirt?
Yeah.
The country?
Kanye on the back of their shirts.
Yeah. They would never do it. Ronaldo would never change the back of his shirt with anyone else's name. And so I feel like when it comes from the organizations, it's a great idea, but in reality, I think it would have been better to just promote it in small ways, put it on mainstream television as an international friendly, make it easy to find, because I found that when I bring people to women's football, they have a good time, but convincing them to go for the very first time is almost like asking them to break their arm.
Just because of maybe the stigma around it?
Yeah, I think the stigma is huge. I went and watched Brøndby in Denmark when I was there, and I invited a family friend who has a young daughter. She's 10. She asked if she could bring two friends. Sure. The dad came, and we're sitting there, and he's leaning back about 10 minutes in and goes, "They're good." "Yeah, they're some of the best in the world." He goes, "Oh, never seen women play before." And now he'll go back, but unless they had that direct connection, they never would have gone to see them play. Yeah. So I think the personal touch is what needs to happen, of having that personal touch, reaching out, grabbing 10 friends who grab 10 more, who grab 10 more. And that's how we'll build the women's game.
Is there anyone you look up to that you think is doing a good job, maybe an ex-pro or current pro?
Yeah, I think Vivian Miedema for Arsenal does a really good job of it. I think she's very straightforward in her interviews that she's a footballer. She's not a female footballer. She's not a girl living her dream. She's a footballer. She's a professional. This is her full-time job. And I think she's doing a good job of setting the standard for the next generation. You can be really good and it can be your full-time job. Because I think I'm only 24, but my generation, a lot of us didn't think we could ever go pro. It just wasn't an idea I had as a little girl versus, you know, most little boys, especially in England, think that one day they're going to be a pro.
Right. Every little boy. You're right. When was the moment that changed for you where you were like, actually, I can go pro?
The moment I got my first offer to go pro.
Really?
Out. Yeah.
So you weren't actively thinking this is going to happen. It kind of came to you.
Yeah, it came to me. And even now I've played in a couple different countries and I've had pro contracts and I still find myself almost afraid to announce that it's my full-time job. Like, oh, it's not real. It can't really be a full-time job. And I think a lot of girls feel the same way, that, you know, you can be an athlete, but what are you after? Mm-hmm. What are you at the same time? Because it's not enough to make a full living. So what else are you doing? Do you describe yourself as your side hustles or as a footballer?
It is an identity that is still taking its time to be the norm, isn't it? To treat us all as just footballers rather than, oh, you're a female footballer and you're a male footballer. Because it does seem like those two still carry different weights for most people. What's next for you then? I mean, now you are a professional. Has that changed the scope of your 10-year plan, 5-year plan? Do you see yourself getting into coaching, training, or anything like that? Or do you think you'll get enough out of the game just from playing?
I would like to keep playing abroad and I would like to stay in Europe. So I've accepted the point that it's going to be a rocky journey and it's probably not going to make a lot of money, but it will be this January transfer window opens up again. See where the chips fall.
Yeah.
Hopefully a team reaches out and it's a good fit. And that's where I'll end up going for 6 months, a year, 2 years. I think coaching is incredibly important. I have my FA level one. I coach as part of the academy in Denmark. And I think we need more women coaching. Mm-hmm. You know, as great as the male coaches I've had my whole life have been, I've only had two female coaches in 18 years of playing. So I think that needs to change. And I really enjoy the tactical and technical part of it. Mm-hmm. Thinking what's the best formation, what's the best position for a player, dependent on their specific skill sets. So when I end up hanging up my boots because I can't play anymore, I would love to transition into coaching.
Anything you've learned through your journey will influence the way you coach?
Yeah, I think my main takeaway is that there's different styles of players and that's okay. You know, I've gone to some sessions and the only thing they do is close control dribbling because the coach happened to be a number 8 in a tiki-taka team
and
was good at close control dribbling. But there's also a beauty in a center back who can send a 60-yard pass and being able to see young players especially and say, you know, it's great to have all these tools, but you don't need to be this one specific. If you just want to be that vocal, aggressive player, we need those. You don't need to be the Messi of a team. You can value being the Van Dijk. You can value being a Beckham. You can value being a Vivian Miedema, whoever you want to be. So I think embracing that different cultures and different styles in different countries is important.
That's awesome. So anyone listening who maybe whatever circumstances they're in, they feel like maybe it's not possible or their influences around them maybe don't encourage them to pursue this as a career option, what would you say to those people? What have you learned through your journey that you could pass on as just some encouraging words?
Yeah, I think the first step is accepting it yourself. You know, when you decide I'm a footballer, that's what I do. I think that helps opening doors for you, whether that's, you know, changing your profession on LinkedIn or on Instagram and accepting that people might reach out to you about it is huge. And I also think making sure it's still fun, because I think a lot of people put so much pressure on themselves to succeed that it almost feels like if they don't, there's nothing else out there. At the end of the day, football is, it's a game. It should be fun. You should enjoy it. And if you enjoy it and you share that passion for it, I think the right people will reach out to you. And whether that's playing on a Sunday team or whether that's going pro, I think that if you reach out for it and it's still fun for you, you'll have success.
I love that. Last question for you. So I didn't want to prep you for it, but I asked this at the end of my podcasts. I wanted to deliberately not tell you just because I want it to be raw, and your answer might change this depending on what stage of life you're at. But in this moment, to you, what does it mean to fulfill your potential?
I think for me, fulfilling my potential is taking my unique background, because I do think the way I grew up playing pickup with the guys in the dirt behind a boys and girls club to then go playing in university, then go playing abroad. I think to fill my potential is to keep trying, even when it gets a little bit rougher, because I know the guys I grew up with would love to be in my shoes right now. So to do it for them, and that family community you have is that people are on your side. So you need to support yourself and then also show respect to them for everything they've done.
I love that. So anyone listening who maybe wants to find you, if they maybe have questions for you, where can they get in touch with you? Do you have any blogs, anything online that people can access?
Yeah, I'm pretty active on social media. So Instagram is usually the best, just first name underscore last name, Lily Dubuck. Okay. And then reach out via there and I'll, you know, do my best to respond and advise you or share my stories, hear your stories.
Awesome. I'll put all that in the show notes. Well, Lily, it's been a pleasure getting a different perspective today. You've had a lot of really cool experiences. And I love hearing about different cultures. And it's just nice to get another perspective on the women's game, how it compares to the men's game, how the gap's closing, what still needs to be done. And it's exciting to see because there are so many talented women out there. Unbelievable. I remember when I was playing in college, like I said, at least six of those girls who would play on the women's team could have easily took our starting spots, and they would give us the runaround every lunchtime pretty much. But sometimes they don't get the opportunities they deserve or as much appreciation or applause. So thanks for giving us your time today.
Yeah, thank you. I had a great time.
So that's it for today's episode of the 7MLC podcast. It was an absolute pleasure getting to speak with Lily today. And what an incredible story, growing up in a remote town and then going on to play professionally. And it wasn't something she was necessarily working towards, but that just goes to show you that opportunity comes knocking at the most unexpected moments. And sometimes you just got to be ready to answer the door, and Lily certainly did. And the best part about her story, it's not even over yet. So I'm excited to see where she ends up next in the January transfer window. Hopefully we can catch up with her in the near future and get an update on that. But I hope you enjoyed today's episode and took away a lot of value from it. I know I certainly did. Remember to subscribe to the 7MLC podcast for more episodes and more guests that will be coming on the channel in the near future. If you do have time and you can leave a review, I'd really appreciate it, as it helps spread these messages far and wide to the players and people that might need to hear them. I'm going to be back with another episode very soon, but until then, go out there and fulfill your potential.